Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, good friends. Welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to this week's roundtable, coming to you from our nation's capital on this Friday morning, July 15, about 8:30 a.m., and the end of a very busy news week, starting off with yet another blockbuster hearing of the January 6th committee, this one focusing on Donald Trump's ties with violent extremist organizations and allegations of witness tampering by the former president, to which Trump responded by saying he's already made up his mind about whether or not he'll run to get his old job back in 2024. Well, we know what the answer is. The only question is, when? Which wasn't necessarily welcome news to Senate Republicans. They're already worried about losing ground in the midterms, thanks to, shall we say, several less than stellar Senate candidates that Trump has foisted on his own party. And Joe Biden gets the public adulation and high poll numbers in Israel that he only wishes he could get back here at home. Lots of ground to cover for today's panel. Elena Treen joining us, congressional reporter for Axios and co-author of the Axios sneak peek newsletter, rather. Hi, Elena.
Hi, Bill. Thank you so much for having me on.
Jeff Duffer, editor-in-chief at National Journal. Good to have you back, Jeff.
Hi, Bill.
And Philip Bump, national political correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the newsletter, How to Read This Chart. Hello, Philip.
Good morning, sir.
Okay, so let's jump right in.
Early in the morning of December 19th, the president sent out a tweet urging his followers to travel to Washington, D.C. for January 6th. Be there. We'll be wild, the president wrote. This tweet served as a call to action and in some cases as a call to arms.
Philip, a blockbuster hearing indeed. To use the overused phrase, I guess, the question is, are these hearings moving the needle in any way?
Well, it's interesting. We've seen polling that suggests a couple of things. The first is we saw polling earlier, about mid-June, maybe 2 weeks into the hearings, that suggested that across the board, Americans were more likely to say that they thought Donald Trump had committed a crime. And that was among Democrats, independents, and Republicans. That said, I looked actually at the numbers earlier this week from YouGov, which does polling fairly, very consistently. And one thing that is clear from that polling is that Donald Trump's favorability rating, which obviously is a measure of how people feel about him broadly, is down significantly among independents since the hearings started, but has not dropped at all among Republicans, which I think obviously can be attributed to a number of factors, including that they remain fairly insulated from news about this. Fox News, of course, being the, mm-hmm. you know, the go-to cable news network for the right, is when it's covering this, is very quickly slathering on some framing that diminishes the effects of Donald Trump. And I think we're seeing that reflected in the fact that Republicans aren't being moved very much.
So overall, not having much of an impact, the hearings?
These are things that are sort of hard to measure outside of the context of an actual election when you can have people actually weigh in on it. But yeah, I would say that so far it does not seem to be the case that a lot of Republicans are second guessing their assessments of Donald Trump.
And there's the both political impact potential and the legal. Elena, you've looked at some of the political impact, particularly on Senate races, correct?
Yes. Well, it's difficult, I think. And Philip was exactly right. The challenge that the committee had from the beginning is, regardless of what they say and lay out in the series of hearings, Republicans really are staying firm in their loyalty to Donald Trump. And that's not across the board. Of course, you have two Republicans on the committee itself, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. But by and large, Republicans are holding fast to supporting Donald Trump and defending him and really trying to, you know, avoid talking about January 6th at all. The difficulty, though, is a lot of Americans are actually watching and find what's happening really troubling. But I think that when it comes to Democrats, a lot of the people who might be swayed by these hearings are actually, you know, would already be against voting for Republicans in the midterm elections anyway. But I do think that Republicans are definitely eager to potentially reframe the narrative. I did a story recently on how if, particularly in the House, Republicans take back the majority, next year they're looking at launching their own investigations into the January 6th committee, how they've gotten their funding, some of the records that they've obtained in the process of that. And that's really just to show that as much as they're avoiding that conversation now, because it isn't a political winner for them, but it after the elections, they're very much eager to dig into it on their own through their own investigations and see if they can reshape what happened that day and kind of reclaim the narrative of January 6th.
And Jeff, the real bombshell at the hearing on Tuesday came at the very, very end when Vice Chair Liz Cheney dropped her bomb about the latest involvement, if you will, that we've heard, or potential involvement from the former president himself. Here's Liz Cheney.
And one more item. After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation. That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us, and this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice.
So, Jeff, first of all, I love the fact that she just starts out like, oh, and by the way, one more item. Boom, right? So what do you think about this in terms of the legal problem potential for Donald Trump?
Well, I would imagine there's a little bit more evidence than just that he called. There's a lot of plausible deniability. You could just say, well, it was a butt dial. did he leave a voicemail? Is there some sort of bigger record than that? I don't know. But in terms of his legal peril, it's... he's had mixed news on this for months now. Good news from New York, bad news from Georgia, and then there's the big question of Merrick Garland hanging over all this. I talked to Norm Eisen a few weeks ago before the hearings even started. Eisen, of course, was the House Judiciary Counsel for the first impeachment. And I asked him about the Trump indictment, and he said his money was on the Fulton County prosecutor in Georgia indicting Trump before Garland does, if Garland ever does. I tend to agree. He's on tape in Georgia soliciting election obstruction pretty clearly, and that prosecutor is very, very aggressive, certainly seems to be more aggressive than Garland has proven to be. I think it strikes me that Garland is playing by the old rules, respecting the kind of quote unquote guardrails of democracy that people like to talk about that don't seem to exist any longer. You know, we don't indict the loser of our elections here in this country. But at the same time, no loser of an election in this country has ever tried to do what Trump did. So now what? Where does that leave us? And I would just remind people that federal agents raided Rudy Giuliani's house more than a year ago, and we haven't heard anything else since, really, on that front.
Garland also seems to be playing by the rules of not politicizing, right, the Justice Department, as if that did not happen under Donald Trump with Bill Barr. Yeah. So Philip Donald Trump, doesn't like the portrait of himself being portrayed by the January 6th committee, maybe doesn't like the fact that he's not front and center when people are talking about the midterm elections, so let it known this week that he has made up his mind about 2024. Should we doubt what his decision is?
Yeah, I mean, I think that
it's sort of striking the language that he used in that interview with New York Magazine was very similar to the language he used in May of 2015 when he said he made up his mind and he just was, you know, figuring out when he was going to do it. So I have long been sort of on the fence as to whether or not I thought he was going to run. I think the subject we were just talking about, this threat of political criminal prosecution, is probably going to tilt him. If there was any real doubt in his mind, which I think there probably was, I think that may tilt him towards actually making the run. It'd be much, much harder for Merrick Garland of the Justice Department to announce any criminal charges against Donald Trump if he is actively seeking the nomination of the Republican Party to run against Joe Biden in 2024. It makes it much more complicated. I do think it's worth noting that I think people are sort of underestimating the extent to which the Justice Department is moving forward. I think that Merrick Garland, yes, I mean, this is an incredibly fraught decision that Merrick Garland will have to make, but there are very clear signs that they are taking active steps. I mean, the Rudy Giuliani thing, yes, his records are seized, but there's this huge fight in the courts over whether or not they should be protected under attorney-client privilege. And you know, there was a special master that was determined to evaluate the contents of this of the material that was seized. You know, it's a very, very slow process. It's very different than the January 6th committee, which can move at its own pace. It doesn't have to worry about things like criminality and proving those cases. So, you know, I think that is still a very real possibility. I think Justice Department is moving very actively. And I think that may be a key trigger for why Donald Trump is saying, hey, maybe I should jump into this thing sooner rather than later.
I just want to be sure, Philip, I understand you. But you're saying that were Donald Trump to announce, Republicans would make the argument, well, you can't indict a sitting president, but you also cannot indict, or it's not fair to indict, a candidate for president. Really?
Yeah, I think that.
Really?
I think they'll make that argument. Right. I mean, I think that Donald Trump would very quickly say, oh, they're only doing this because I'm running for president. Right. Like he gives himself this political out that further diminishes the extent to which his own base would see this as being a valid prosecution. I don't think there's validity to it. Of course, just because you're the Justice Department thinks you've committed a crime. You can't. This is not a get out of jail free card to run for president, or everyone would be doing it. Right. You know, Al Capone would have run for president in 1930, whatever. but I think that it makes it a more politically problematic issue for the Justice Department.
Now, I know, Elena, this is back to the question you thought I'd asked earlier. I know this is tough to put ourselves in the mind of a Mitch McConnell, for example, but if you're Mitch McConnell and you really want to get the Senate back so you can get your old job back, and you hear Donald Trump's going to run, announce that he's running, like in September, that's the latest word, you're Mitch McConnell. Is that good news?
I don't think Republicans are that happy about a potential Trump announcement, to be honest. And it's interesting, you know, midterms are often a referendum on the president in office.
Right.
Everyone's expecting November to be about Joe Biden. But if Trump were to announce prior to November, it could potentially also become a referendum on him. And I think a lot of Democrats are eager for that. We've seen throughout their campaign messaging, a lot of the advertising and fundraising dollars are coming from attacks still about the former president. It's interesting too, though. I think that if you look at Senate races, Donald Trump is definitely responsible for some of the less than stellar candidates that we're seeing in some of these battleground races. I think you look at Arizona, you know, Doug Ducey, I know a lot of Republicans would have loved for him to run, but because the former president had attacked him so viciously, it really prevented him from ever having a real shot at trying to throw his hat in the ring. And now they have Blake Masters, who is very controversial. You look at New Hampshire, Maggie Hassan could have had a much tougher time running if Governor Chris Sununu went into the race. Mm-hmm. And Donald Trump's attacks on him also, I think, contributed to him wanting to stay out of that. And it's the same thing we see candidates, J.D. Vance, Herschel Walker, they aren't having as great fundraising numbers as I think a lot of Republicans would have hoped. And their candidates, Dr. Oz is another one in Pennsylvania, they're candidates that Mitch McConnell, I think if he had his own choice, probably would have tried to have pushed mm-hmm. other people forward. And so Donald Trump is still so ingrained in the fabric of politics, but also really with these midterms. And I think him running would just add to a lot of the anxiety that a lot of Republicans are having about how big can they try to win in their margins. And will he really have a hold on how big those numbers can be.
Yeah, you've done a lot of reporting on those Senate candidates. I'm going to get back to them in just a little bit. But meanwhile, Jeff, you put yourself in the mind of Joe Biden. I saw Charlie Sykes in the Bulwark yesterday said the best thing that could happen for Joe Biden would be for Donald Trump to announce that he's running in September.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
Absolutely. I've long thought, for instance, that the January 6th hearings wouldn't have any bearing on 22, but they might have a bearing on 2024 and shaping that race and Trump's viability in 2024. But now what happens if 2024 suddenly inserts itself into 2022?
Yeah.
And now it's a binary choice, or at least Democrats can portray it as a binary choice. As Elena's publication scooped yesterday or the day before, Trump is returning to Washington this month for the first time since the end of his presidency. He's going to speak at a big conservative confab, the America First Policy Institute. It's obviously going to happen. I believe him when he says it's probably going to happen around in the fall, probably in September. And I also believe, after observing him for 5 or 6 years, that he is not particularly concerned with what it does to Mitch McConnell or what Republicans at large think about it. He's going to do it on his own time frame for whatever makes sense for him. And he knows that his very loud and very vocal supporters, even if it's only 25 or 30% of the country, will be right there with him. And the other 65, 70% of the country can go to hell. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much always the way he's operated, and nothing's going to change this time around.
And one thing for sure, if he does announce in September, the midterms will be all about him, right? Which is actually
I'm sure that has a degree of appeal to him. It certainly does not have a degree of appeal for Kevin McCarthy or Mitch McConnell. McCarthy, I think, is gonna be fine. But as Lennon was just saying, McConnell's got some real trouble here with what we might euphemistically call candidate quality, or less euphemistically, we might call nominating crazy people who could be really vulnerable in the fall in races that they might otherwise win. And because these are backed by Trump, then of course he shows up on the campaign trail with them, and he's declared for president, and it all becomes the Trump show again,
right?
Which there's plenty of polling data that suggests that people are growing weary of the Trump show.
Well, picking up on that phrase, crazy people, and Elena was also talking about some of the Senate races. Philip, come back to kind of where do we start? Well, let's start in Georgia with Herschel Walker. I saw this week Herschel Walker's comments about evolution, right? Where, roughly quoting, I'm not sure word for word, but that some people say that man descended from the apes. Well, if that's so, why are there still apes around? Think about that, he says, right?
Right. Yeah, and honestly, I think it's not even the first time he said that. He also said that, you know, one of the issues with climate change is that there is dirty air in China that blows over the United States and it gets rid of our clean air. And that's, I mean, it's just, you know, look, I don't think there's any real question. Herschel Walker is not a top tier Senate candidate. You know, that can be measured in a lot of different ways. I do think, though, that there's this weird divide between Joe Biden's low approval rating and the generic ballot in Congress. And normally we see those things move in sync, and that as a president gets less popular, his party tends to be faring less well in congressional races, right? This is the standard thing for midterms, and the Democratic Party should be doing worse in the congressional ballot than it is currently. And I say all that to say, I think there is still a chance that the congressional ballot measures are overstating how strong the Democrats' position is at this point in time, and therefore that there may be a bigger wave this year for the Republicans than people expect. And I think that this is the if I'm a Democrat at this point, this is the thing that I'm most worried about. And so we see, for example, these efforts to boost candidates like Carrie Lake in Arizona and Herschel Walker in Georgia, thinking that they are worse against Democrats. And that may be, I think that's pretty clear, right? Herschel Walker is not the ideal candidate taking on Raphael Warnock. But I think that this underestimates the extent to which this could be an extremely bad year for Democrats. That then means that all of these people, you know, like these candidates, Greitens in Missouri or Mastriano in Pennsylvania, these guys who are hard right people and who have very willingly jumped on board this, you know, this isn't a democracy, this is a republic, and we need to have a stronger hand determining election outcomes, that these people could be in positions of power. And I think that this is a very real danger. And yeah, Herschel Walker's a bad candidate, but, you know, he could very well be also the next senator from Georgia. And I think that's a risk that the Democrats are underestimating.
Right. Let's take a look at New Jersey, Elena. One of the most unusual political ads I've seen in my career came this week. An ad poking fun at Mehmet Oz, the Republican nominee for Senate in Pennsylvania, who recently moved to Pennsylvania from New Jersey. And so the John Fetterman campaign enlisted the actress Nicole Polizzi, better known as Snooki, who is like Miss New Jersey, to welcome Mehmet Oz to Pennsylvania in this tongue-in-cheek commercial. Here it is.
Hey, Mehmet. This is Nicole Snooki. I heard that you moved from New Jersey to Pennsylvania to look for a new job. I want to say best of luck to you. I know you're away from home and you're in a new place. And don't worry, because you'll be back home in Jersey soon. This is only temporary.
What's going on, Elena? Is Mehmet Oz the ideal candidate here for the Republicans in Pennsylvania?
Oh, well, it's just... to hear that, I'm from New Jersey, so to hear the Jersey Shore references is very funny to me. Listen, the Pennsylvania race is super interesting, and I think, you know, just also look at John Fetterman. I mean, after he had a stroke right around the time that he won the nomination or the primary, I think that he's having his own troubles on the campaign trail. He hasn't been out there that much. He hasn't been.
We haven't seen him in two months, right?
On the trail. Exactly. But I do think at the same time, he would be in a much more vulnerable position if he was running against a stronger Republican candidate. And Mehmet Oz does have a lot of issues. And you're right. He's been criticized by Fetterman, but also many other Democrats as being a carpetbagger from New Jersey. And he's really well known, but also really disliked by many people. And that's something that Fetterman's campaign has going for them. And Mehmet Oz is definitely a very problematic candidate in some ways. He's also not that politically savvy. I mean, I think just as much as Fetterman right now doesn't want to engage in debates. I think they both equally are trying to avoid that for Oz's reasons. He's not as great on the political aspect of navigating some of the questions and things like that. But he does have Trump's support. That's definitely what got him over the line to win against David McCormick. But I do know that a lot of Democrats think that if Fetterman right now was running against McCormick, it would be a very different dynamic and a much tougher race for him. But because Mehmet Oz has so many vulnerabilities and a lot of issues and things going back again to his where he's moved, but also looking at his finances and things of that sort, he's very controversial, and that's giving Fetterman a leg up for sure and keeping Democrats hopeful that they could potentially clinch that seat and flip it and try to take back the seat that Pat Toomey's had for so long now.
So, Jeff, we've talked about Herschel Walker and Mehmet Oz. There's also, Elena mentioned earlier, Eric Greitens with his problems in Missouri, Blake Masters with his problems in Arizona, J.D. Vance to a certain extent, but he's not a clown like I think some of these others are. I mean, I've seen several stories that Democrats have sort of given up on the House, but they're feeling better about the Senate, and Republicans are more nervous about the Senate. What's your take?
I think that's right. I think Democrats could be cautiously optimistic that they could break even in the Senate. Now, a lot of things still have to go their way. And we're not going to know. The polls aren't going to really become clear until after these last few nomination contests wrap up in August, September. and we start seeing some real general election polling with voters really paying attention. But you mentioned Ohio, and yeah, polls there are much closer than Republicans would like them to be. In North Carolina also, Sherry Beasley is running a pretty good campaign against Ted Budd, who Ted Budd is just kind of a generic backbench House candidate. He doesn't really have the dynamism of, let's say, Burr or Tillis, who are a little bit more, they're still conservative, but they're pretty interesting guys. And they have a little bit wider appeal. Bud's appeal is still pretty narrow on the GOP side. Mm-hmm. So that race is not a given for Republicans either. And especially in this kind of climate, that says a lot. On the House side, just anecdotally, I'll say I was at an event last night with a lot of Republicans, and I happened to walk into a conversation where they were all going around saying how many seats they expected to pick up. And they were still saying, this is a group of about 8 Republicans, they were still saying, throwing out numbers like 45, 55, 63. And this is 2 months ago, maybe you could have mm-hmm. justified those numbers. But this is, I mean, I just don't think there's enough seats out there. I think they're going to be mistaken. I don't think there numerically are enough competitive seats out there for them to win. Remember, for instance, in 1994, when the Gingrich revolution swept in, Republicans started with 174 seats, which meant they had a really high ceiling. They had they had a lot of seats that they could win. Now they're starting with 211. There just aren't that many on the board for them to win 63. You'd have to win like every Biden plus 12 district or less mm-hmm. in order to get that kind of a number. So I think it's more in the 15 to 25 range, if I had to guess right now.
Right. Okay. Good look at the political landscape across the country at every level. Let's take a quick break and get back to some of the other news of the week here with today's panel. Philip Bump from The Washington Post, Jeff Dufour from The National Journal, Elena Treen from Axios. This is the Bill Press Pod. And today's roundtable brought to you by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, the Teamsters Union, the largest and the most diverse of all of America's labor unions, with over 1.5 million members, covering every single aspect of the American workforce, from vegetable workers in California, construction workers in Las Vegas, brewery workers in St. Louis, and bakery workers in Maine. As they say, they represent everybody from A to Z, from airline pilots to zookeepers, under the leadership of the new Teamster president, Sean O'Brien. We salute the Teamsters for their good work and thank them for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
back with today's roundtable. Jeff Dufour joins us from the National Journal, Elena Treen from Axios and Axios Sneak Peek Newsletter, and Philip Bump, national political correspondent for the Washington Post. Well, an interesting exchange, Philip, on CNN the other day, in talking about the January 6th committee and the insurrection as a possible coup. Jake Tapper invited as a guest former National Security Advisor John Bolton under Donald Trump. And this interesting exchange about what it takes to stage a coup. Here's Bolton and Jake Tapper.
I don't know that I agree with you, to be fair, with all due respect. One doesn't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah,
not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work.
Whoa. Philip, you've looked into this. How many coups and where?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I did look into this. I pulled some data from the University of Illinois Klein Center, which actually documents coups and has since going back to the 1940s. And actually looked at Bolton's tenure in politics and where it overlapped with some of these coup attempts taking place. There were hundreds over the course of the time that Bolton was in office, most of them in places that the United States had no direct, obvious interest. But, you know, I mean, his tenure overlapped with a lot of things with which we're familiar. You know, the ouster of Manuel Noriega in Panama, the Ceausescu revolution in Romania, the revolution in Georgia. I mean, there are all these things that occurred in Haiti, Aristide, the ouster of Aristide. There are all these things that overlapped with his time in office. I mean, he cops later in that interview to having been involved in trying to help the Venezuelans get rid of Maduro when he was national security advisor. He sort of hinted that there were other things in which he participated as well. And I think there are two important things here. The first is just sort of the blitheness with which he just sort of admitted, oh, yeah, you know, here are the places that where the American government was trying to overthrow foreign leadership is obviously something that I think people sort of recognize, but is not the sort of thing you're supposed to say just sort of that casually. But I also think it's important to remember that John Bolton, you know, for all of the stuffiness that he tries to present, he's very much a guy who's what kids today would call a clout chaser. And he wants to be seen as this important actor in the world stage in American history. And so, you know, who knows? Maybe he came across an old memo from Oliver North talking about Nicaragua and, you know, felt like he was part of the plot just as a result of that, trying to hype himself up. It's sort of hard to take anything John Bolton says necessarily at face value as well.
It seems like he also wants to be a part of the conversation, right? And this was one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he was doing this intentionally, but I mean, honestly, that my first instinct was he's been in this longstanding feud with Donald Trump, who fired him from his position. And I think he was just trying to be like, Donald Trump's too stupid to do it, whereas I, however, am very smart. I think that was probably the core motivator for his making that comment.
Jeff, let me jump to another big story of the day. As we speak, President Biden is winding up his visit first to Israel, to the West Bank today, and on his way to Saudi Arabia, a visit that provides opportunities for certain rewards, but also just as many risks, correct?
Yeah, I would really break the trip into two parts. The two visits are very different for him. Israel for Biden is much, much easier to navigate than Saudi Arabia. Biden is he referred to himself as a Zionist yesterday in Tel Aviv. He has referred to himself as a Zionist for decades, really. He pointed out that he has had a relationship with every Israeli prime minister going back to Golda Meir. And as Bill, your friend and mine, George Condon, our White House correspondent, wrote yesterday, usually Biden has taken pains to differentiate himself with Trump when he's taken these foreign trips. Here, it was almost as if he was trying to put daylight between himself and Obama, because the Israelis really never took to Obama. They never trusted him. Obama was always trying to get them to make concessions that they didn't want, whereas Biden swoops in as a longtime friend and ally. Saudi Arabia is a much different beast. He's doing this essentially out of necessity. It's a total no-win situation. You're either cozying up to the guy who ordered the murder of Khashoggi, or you look like you're doing nothing about gas prices. Either way, it's a GOP attack ad in the making. So I'm curious to see his remarks as the day goes on today.
At the same time, you'd have to admit that he had to go there. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I think that's right. But it puts him in a very, very politically precarious situation.
With the position of Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, you just can't ignore it. Elena, I want to jump to another issue that we caught up with just the last couple of days. And that is the tragic story of a girl, 10-year-old in Ohio, who was raped. She and her parents certainly did not want her to carry that child. I guess if she were capable of it, I guess she was physically. And they went to Indiana, where she was able to have an abortion, which led to this exchange in a congressional hearing yesterday with Congressman Eric Swalwell asking the president of Americans United for Life, a woman by the name of Catherine Glenn Foster, her take on this sad situation. Here's the exchange with Congressman Swalwell.
Do you think a 10-year-old should choose to carry a baby?
I believe it would probably impact her life. And so therefore, it would fall under any exception and would not be an abortion.
Wait. It would not be an abortion if a 10-year-old with her parents made the decision not to have a baby that was a result of a rape?
If a 10-year-old became pregnant as a result of rape and it was threatening her life, then that's not an abortion.
There was another witness who a health provider who followed up and said clearly that was disinformation. No matter how sad the situation is, that was, in fact, a medical procedure known as an abortion. My question, Elena, is this a glimpse into post-Roe reality?
It definitely is. And, I mean, the story is just heartbreaking. And it was also shocking to see a lot of Republicans as well. I know Congressman Jim Jordan tweeted, he ended up taking it down, but called the story a lie. A lot of Republicans shocked that someone who was 10 years old could get pregnant. But of course she did. And that's why they sought to have an abortion for her. It's an interesting, anecdote for the broader story of what's happening. After Roe, of course, many Republicans celebrating the decision for the Supreme Court to overturn the decision. But now, politically, a lot of Republicans really don't want to focus that much on it. It's not great for them, particularly in certain states and more battleground and purple states. It's not a great issue for them. They'd rather focus on the economy. They'd rather focus on inflation. And the question of how far-reaching the decision to overturn Roe will be is crucial. And Republicans are really split on exceptions. It's remarkable looking back to the Reagan era, and even former President Trump supported exceptions for abortions in cases of rape, incest, and preserving the life of the mother. And increasingly, we're seeing the Republican Party as a whole become more conservative. And many of the candidates that we talked about, Senate candidates like Herschel Walker and J.D. Vance and some of the crucial Senate states, taking hardline views against some of these exceptions. And to have a story about this girl just puts in perspective how real it is for people. I think sometimes, politicians talk about policies, and I think abortion is one of them, where you can kind of get detached from the reality of what it means for people. And this story did a really good job of showing just how tragic and difficult this ruling can be for people, and particularly women across the country. And definitely, I think, contributes to the difficulties of how to navigate decisions on how far spread the ruling should be and abortion state by state, but also politically how difficult it is to navigate as well.
Philip, Elena referred to the response on the part of some Republicans. I mean, Jim Jordan famously, he tweeted right away, another big lie, are you surprised? The Wall Street Journal in an editorial said, how dare Joe Biden talk about this because it never happened. Fox News, of course, said this was all a lie. It never happened. And then immediately after we find out that the guy that they found the rapist and he was charged with this rape, the Indiana Attorney General still goes on the attack against the doctor who performed this procedure in Indiana. Here's the Todd Rokita, the Indiana Attorney General.
We have this abortion activist acting as a doctor. So we're gathering the information, we're gathering the evidence as we speak, and we're going to fight this to the end, including looking at her licensure. If she failed to report in Indiana, it's a crime to intentionally not report.
Across the board, Philip, tone deaf, I guess, to be polite, right?
I mean, from an objective standpoint, yes,
yeah,
but not from the standpoint of who they're trying to reach as their audience.
Good point.
You know, I think, first of all, that it's worth pointing out the Washington Post has confirmed that the doctor in Indiana did report this as she was obligated
yes.
to do. So that argument from Mr. Akita obviously doesn't hold any water. Look, there are a few things I'd say. I would say, first of all, that this is a manifestation of a pattern that began in earnest in late 2015, wherein the Republicans, anytime they're faced with news that works against them politically, they say it's a lie. That is, you know, that was sort of inculcated in the Trump era as a defense mechanism. And I think that we see this having carried over into the current discussion. I think, second, that the point here is fairly obvious. This is the sort of example of things that people said, we need to be cautious about abortion because horrible things happen and we need to be able to deal with horrible things. And this is, you know, Rokita tried to frame this as the doctor as being an activist who was trying to promote abortion.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, she thinks that it's important that a 10-year-old who's raped by someone not have to carry the baby to term. Yes, that's right. She's an activist on behalf of that cause. But this was seen as being something that was politically damaging. And I think the response to try and downplay and dismiss it as fake was a recognition tacitly that this was politically damaging. But I think it also reflects, especially the Rokita example, which I wrote about yesterday, it reflects that there is still this appetite for treating abortion as something to be dealt with harshly, right? I mean, already Roe has been overturned. The right has won on that point. But there is still an appetite among many on the right to be even more fervent in response. And so there had been some discussion, you know, there's this piece at The Atlantic, for example, last week about how now the Republicans who are pro-life need to sort of move to the middle and be more embracing of women. But there's still this appetite to actually go further to the right. And that's what we saw from Rokita.
Yeah. So let's wrap, Jeff, and give you the last word. Well, and I'm sort of the same question I began this roundtable with. Does this issue move the needle in terms of voters in the midterms or have the potential for doing so?
Definitely has the potential, because I think this episode shows that a lot of Republicans don't yet have the political vocabulary to talk about this yet. You know, they haven't given the whole Frank Luntz workshop to their language. There are so many subtleties of this issue and how it can play out in real life. I mean, wait until anti-abortion Republicans start having to answer debate questions on stage about, let's say, ectopic pregnancies, for example. It just gets so in the weeds and they're not well-versed on it. James Bopp is the architect of the anti-abortion legal strategy going back 40 years or so. He gave a very interesting interview to the New York Times a week or two ago in which he laid out his legal and moral theories on abortion. But then he comes out after this Ohio case and says that if he wrote the law, yes, the 10-year-old would have to in fact carry this child to term. And a lot of politicians in red states have felt compelled to take that same position. And this is a 15% position in America. I would almost liken it to how in 2020, it's almost gospel now that defund the police and Medicare for all cost Democrats some winnable seats in the suburbs. Voters were going, hey, well, wait a minute. But what else would make voters say in the suburbs say, hey, whoa, wait a minute? Telling them that their 10-year-old, if their 10-year-old is raped, she has to carry the baby. It's just the kind of issue that immediately repels swing voters.
Not one that Republicans will rush to embrace. One would think not, exactly. And with that, a great big thank you for a great look at today's the news of the week with today's panel, Elena Treen from Axios and Jeff Dufour, National Journal, and Philip Bump, of course, from The Washington Post. But we won't let you go without just asking you, what was the one story this week that stopped you in your tracks to either laugh or cry or scratch your head about it? We call it our favorite story of the week. Where do we start? Elena, how about you?
I really enjoyed, I saw this yesterday, that amid all of these different places having to raise their prices because of inflation, we saw, you know, the Dollar Tree up there. I think when I was on the show last, actually, I talked about the Dollar Tree raising. It's no longer just a dollar anymore. Same thing with Dollar Pizza in New York and things like that. But Costco is keeping its $1.50 combo for a hot dog and fountain soda, which I just thought is great. And they were very – the CEO of Costco is very clear that that's not going to be changing. And part of the reason they're able to do that is because they brought production in-house for their hot dogs. But they are holding firm in the same deal that they've had since the 80s when they first announced the – $1.50 combo. So kudos to Costco for being able to pull that off.
I can't tell you how glad I was to see that story because I'm a Costco shopper and I always time my Costco shopping around the noon hour so I can have that hot dog special.
They're great. Costco. They're great hot dogs.
No, they are indeed. Costco and a cold drink for actually with tax, it comes out to $1.65 in Virginia, which is about the cheapest damn lunch you can get anywhere in the country. So good for Costco. All right. Philip Bump, what caught your attention?
As a Costco cheese pizza eater, I will refrain from that discussion. What caught my attention this week was on the same day that the January 6th House Committee had mentioned that Andy Biggs, representative from Arizona, was among those who met with Donald Trump in the White House about 2 weeks before the January 6th insurrection in an effort to discuss the plan for Trump to retain power. Biggs was circulating a letter among his colleagues calling for a new investigation by the House into the film 2000 Mules by Dinesh D'Souza. This caught my attention in part because I am absolutely obsessed with this movie because it is so dumb and so distant from offering any evidence, and yet has been very, very widely embraced. Dinesh D'Souza, the filmmaker, has done a very good job of actually convincing people that it makes the case that it doesn't. It is so obviously full of nonsense that I'm actually astonished that anyone would, in good faith, treat it as something worthy of consideration. And yet, once again, Congress does not fail to disappoint in suggesting that this should be something that they spend their time on. So I just sort of, I sort of marveled at the fact that even, you know, the members of Congress who are obviously motivated in what they're trying to get done, nonetheless are suggesting that people waste time on this absolutely useless film.
By the way, didn't Dinesh D'Souza get a pardon from Donald Trump?
As a matter of fact, he did. Yeah, he the great irony is not only that, but that he is being pardoned for essentially election fraud for committing crimes in terms of his straw donor contributions. Right. So, you know, it is what it is.
So there you go. How about you, Jeff? Favorite story?
Yeah, I am an unabashed stan of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. I am a 40-something man, and I am counting down the days till Monday when the next Better Call Saul episode hits my TV. So I was quite tickled to see that the city of Albuquerque, outside its convention center, is about to unveil two bronze statues of Walter White and Jesse Pinkman.
No.
Yeah. They were commissioned by Vince Gilligan, the series' creator, as a gift to Albuquerque, and they are expecting busloads of tourists as a result.
Oh, you know it.
However, it has created a little bit of backlash because unlike the, for instance, the Rocky statue in Philadelphia, which was a portrait of a heroic, if fictional, boxer, as some users on Twitter pointed out, quote, they're erecting statues in honor of characters who were meth dealers, addicts, and murderers in a city known for rampant meth addiction and drug problems. What the F is going on in the world? Point taken.
I can see that point. At the same time, you know, it'll bring a lot of tourist money to Albuquerque, right?
Yep.
So there you go. And I have to say, my favorite story, I love stand-up comedy. Stand-up comics are really one of my favorites. I always have been. And I was really excited this week to see the emergence of a new stand-up comedian who, and you know, a lot of good comedy has come out of Chicago as well. And this was a little, here's a clip from a performance of our latest stand-up comedian given in Chicago just this week.
We in America have some of the cleanest air and cleanest water of anybody in the world.
That's right.
So what we do is we're going to put from the Green New Deal millions or billions of dollars cleaning our good air up. But since we don't control the air, our good air decided to float over to China, bad air. So when China gets our good air, their bad air got to move. So it moves over to our good air state. And now we got to clean that back up.
And of course, that stand-up comedian, Philip, I referred to him a little earlier in the podcast, was none other than Georgia Senate candidate Herschel Walker explaining, there it is, guys, you wondered what climate change was all about, what the problem is that we've got the good air, but our good air moves over to China, and they've got the bad air, and if our good air comes in there, then their bad air comes over here, and that's what climate change is all about.
It's just science, Bill.
So all we need are big fans to keep China's bad air from coming in here. I don't know. I love it. I think we're going to have a favorite story of the latest quote from Herschel Walker from now until after the midterms, for sure. And that's a good wrap here and a great panel today. Thank you so much, Elena Treen from Axios and the Axios Sneak Peek Newsletter, Jeff Dufer, Editor-in-Chief of National Journal, and Philip Pump, with the Washington Post, National Political Correspondent and author of the newsletter, How to Read This Chart. Thank you. Thank you, Philip, Jeff, and Elena. Thank you all for listening today to the Roundtable, and we invite you to come back Tuesday for a very special edition of the Bill Press Pod. We're going to be talking with Mark Leibovich, a good friend of all of ours here from Washington. His latest book is out this week called Thank You for Your Servitude, which is a blistering look at Lindsey Graham, Chris Christie, Kevin McCarthy, and others who basically sacrificed their manhood to the worship of Donald Trump in a very sickening and disgusting way. Mark Leibovich joining us next Tuesday. Have a great weekend, everybody. Come back and see us Tuesday with Mark Leibovich for the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.